This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Good afternoon. It's 6 minutes after 12, and this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, April 15th, 2019. Ahead this hour, an old theater with an impressive legacy will have a new look and a new purpose in downtown Fort Smith soon. 646 Downtown is making the new theater new again and turning it into a space for community productions. We'll have that story in about 8 minutes on today's show. And after our show today, it's NPR's Here and Now. Today, journalist Sonia Nazario is back from a month of reporting about the plight of women in Honduras. The country's ranked as one of the most dangerous places in the world for women. She'll join host Robin Young to talk about Honduras and the crisis at the U.S. border. That's this afternoon at 1 on Here and Now, beginning right after this edition of Ozarks at Large. Tom Main, winner of the Pritzker Architecture Prize, will be on the University of Arkansas campus this afternoon to deliver a lecture titled The Vastness of Interconnectedness. He received the Pritzker, sometimes referred to as the Nobel of Architecture, in 2005, and he also received the American Institute of Architects Gold Medal in 2013. His address is at 4:45 this afternoon in Ken and Linda Sue Schollmeyer Hall in Ball Walker Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. The public is invited to today's talk, and it is free. This is a Monday edition of Ozarks at Large. Friday afternoon, community partners gathered at the groundbreaking ceremony for the New Beginnings Bridge Housing Community. Located in South Fayetteville, this is the region's first bridge housing community. Designed by the University of Arkansas Community Design Center, the goal of the new project is to provide transition housing for the homeless population in the region. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda attended the event, and she brings us this report.
Micro shelter communities exist across the country, and if all goes according to plan, Northwest Arkansas will have its own by winter. Mike Rush, president of the Serve Northwest Arkansas Board of Directors, says these communities have been shown to have a lasting effect in addressing the complex needs of those experiencing homelessness.
They provide shelter to our most vulnerable neighbors, and they provide them a pathway towards receiving comprehensive case management while addressing the root cause of the homeless circumstance. This is a housing-first approach to quickly and successfully connect individuals and families experiencing homelessness to permanent housing without preconditions and while we minimize the barriers to entry.
Rush says his connection to this project began in 2007 when he met Kevin Fitzpatrick, director of the Community and Family Institute at the University of Arkansas. They met after the results of the first Northwest Arkansas point-in-time homeless census was published. According to the 2017 census, an estimated 2,951 homeless people were living in the region at that time. Fitzpatrick says New Beginnings provides a critical component that's been missing in a comprehensive housing plan for the region.
It always has been apparent to me that we were meeting an enormous amount of need. And we're thankful for all of the service providers that not only partner with us, but that will be standing by us as we move forward in this venture. But we still were missing the hardest to reach, the greatest that were challenged, and the most difficult to serve. With New Beginnings, we're hoping to create a community that lowers the bar of entry, that recognizes the importance of safety, security, and stability, and then begins that really difficult process of repairing and reframing lives that carefully and patiently can carve out a path towards secure housing.
Several community partners attended the groundbreaking ceremony, including representatives from the University of Arkansas, the Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce, and the Salvation Army of Northwest Arkansas. Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan says the city has been working to address homelessness in recent years.
This city, I want you to know, over the last 3 years has invested $1.2 million to assist those experiencing homelessness through our general fund and our HUD program. The city established the Hearth Housing Program, which provides an average of 40 housing units and case management. Since 2016, we have housed 89 adults and 96 children.
The New Beginnings Bridge Housing Community will house about 20 people. It's being constructed on 4.7 acres in South Fayetteville that Serve Northwest Arkansas purchased from the U of A. Board President Mike Rush says the initial plan is to build 20 bridge housing facilities.
Every individual is an individual. Every situation is different. They will be assessed. They'll put through case management processes. They'll be given goals and progress. But the first priority is really just get them out of the elements. This is a housing first initiative or an approach. So we want to put people in housing first, safe, secure, dry, warm, clean, so they can really then in that place begin to kind of unpack whatever led them into that situation to begin with. And so, so we'll spend, and those could be from 60 days to 180 days. It just depends. Every situation will be different.
Each unit, which will be about 175 square feet, will include a covered porch, and residents will also have access to communal spaces.
All the residents will have access to community kitchens, to community bathrooms, warming shelters. They'll have all the facilities they need, laundry services, offices for case management. There's even, we have on the plans to have places for pets as well, too, to keep them safe and secure. So it's a full-service place to live. We want this to be a home.
There's still more work to be done, but Rush is pleased with reaching the milestone of breaking ground on the project.
Today's just a remarkable day. It's a little surreal. We've been working on this for 5 years, and the fact that we're able to break ground today because of the support of the community is really hard to say. We know the needs here are overwhelming, and to be able to finally come and to really break ground towards this bridge housing solution is significant. And so we're super excited today. We're super thankful for the community. So many people have come together to make this work, but now the work begins. This is just the beginning, and so we're ecstatic.
The cost of construction and first-year operating costs is estimated to be about $600,000. Rush says they've raised about 90% of that funding so far, thanks to private donations. More information is available at servenwa.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The old New Theater in Fort Smith is about to become new once again. The stage, which hosted some of the great actors of the early 20th century, has been vacant for decades. But now, the building, which first hosted performances in 1911, is being brought back to what it once was. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek tells us more about the theater that will be owned and operated by 646 Downtown.
Talisha Richardson, the executive director of 646 Downtown, unlocks the double doors to 9 North 10th Street, the building that will eventually become a performance venue called the New Theater, the same name it had in the first half of the 20th century.
You see still remnants of the mosaic tile from the original space, if you will.
Right now, those mosaic tiles on the floor are covered in dust, and the air inside is musky, the way it tends to be in 100-year-old buildings undergoing renovation. Most of the walls have been stripped down to the bricks, but some are covered in murals created during the Unexpected project.
So this is actually Doze Green's work from the Unexpected, where we again brought attention to this underutilized space.
That was back in 2017, and Richardson says by the start of 2021, they're hoping the same space will be bustling with theatergoers who will fill the 600 seats in the venue.
So here you see the first floor balcony here. We won't go all the way up just because it's, you know, in this demo fashion, if you will.
The ceiling soars above the two balconies as they open up to the stage, which right now is just a gaping hole in the floor, but at one time hosted the likes of George Arliss, Mary Astor, and Shirley Temple. John McIntosh, who is in charge of production and development for 646 Downtown, says the theater was the center of entertainment in Fort Smith in the early 1900s.
Fort Smith was north and south routing, so a lot of the shows from New York and Chicago routed down to Texas, and they would stop in Fort Smith and play. I mean, a lot of the major productions during the 20s and 30s occurred in that theater. It was a big vaudeville theater.
The Beaux-Arts design of the building came to be thanks to Fort Smith native George Sparks, who was inspired by a visit to the New Amsterdam Theater on New York City's Broadway. The venue went through many renovations over the years, and eventually, McIntosh says, it became a Malco-owned movie theater in the 1940s.
And when the malls took the theaters away from downtown, it really became abandoned. And it's been basically abandoned in one form or another since the mid-1980s.
Richard Griffin and the Griffin Family Trust donated the building to 646 Downtown, which plans to bring it back to its former glory.
The original theater was sort of a Beaux-Arts, sort of an Art Deco nod. And all of that material was taken out when the Malco took it over. It's literally been stripped. None of those features are left. And it is a prohibitive cost to come back and do that. So we'll have a nod to the Beaux-Arts design and architectural design in there, but it'll be a state-of-the-art theater that sort of mimics that off-Broadway look and feel.
McIntosh says the theater is going to fill a gap in the types of venues that operate in the area.
So as a 600-cap venue, it's a really, there's no venue in the mid-size here. There's 1,200 and 1,300, and there's 250. So there's no sweet spot of that 600 seats.
It'll also serve as a community stage that will be open to local nonprofit performing arts groups like the Young Actors Guild and Western Arkansas Ballet.
And the Fort Smith Symphony has shown a great deal of interest for alternative programming because it's a smaller venue and offers a lot of educational opportunities for the symphony.
McIntosh says they also plan to work with the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Theater Arts Department, create a drama program at the Future School, and collaborate with Fort Smith Public Schools.
So it's an opportunity not just for the kids on stage, but for the young people interested in theater education and performing arts education. It's a living, breathing lab with our performing arts education building, and we want it to be that.
The Performance Arts Education Building is another piece of the new theater campus. It'll be right next door and will include a shop, dressing rooms, rehearsal space, classrooms, offices, and a black box theater.
Well, that's so important is when the theater was originally built, that building did not support it because everything was under the stage. The dressing rooms, the scene shops, the restrooms were all under the stage. Well, that didn't quite work these days. So it's important to have all the other buildings that's supporting the theater and the venue.
McIntosh says the theater will also be open to regional promoters and will host nationally touring performances.
And we want to bring in some off-Broadway as well that are a little more innovative. We want to make sure that we reach all the underserved markets in our area. We're going to have an outreach coordinator at some point that goes out into the community and brings those underserved parts of the community into the theater because we want it to be their theater too.
And despite some setbacks following a failed sales tax special election that would have funded the completion of the U.S. Marshals Museum, McIntosh says the two organizations are already discussing collaborating on original programming that focuses on the U.S. Marshals Service.
The Marshals Museum will get completed. The new theater will get completed. So it's a great opportunity to bookend the east end of Garrison and the riverfront. That riverfront's going to continue to develop. We're trying to get the east end of Garrison kicked off and finished off, and then we'll infill Garrison Avenue the rest of the way.
And so far, Talisha Richardson says, the east end of Garrison is off to a good start.
If you look at the location of the new theater in its proximity to Cisterna Park, there's already established commerce, businesses, retail in that particular corridor. So by extending that to offering arts and education, you have another diverse commerce that's entering downtown that once was there.
Richardson says the goal of that diversity of amenities is to keep growing density so that the two can feed off of each other.
We need to increase the density, the people living downtown so that they can partake in all of the amenities that are being created, if you will. So we have to remind people of all the things that have taken place over the last 4 to 5 years and how they're coming together and how sometimes it does take time, but everything is colliding now, which is a good feeling, and the theater is going to take it to the next level.
And John McIntosh adds they're planning for that next level to extend beyond the River Valley.
Look at the arts corridor that's developing in Northwest Arkansas and the River Valley. You know, we're getting closer and closer every year to tie together. We've had collaborations with Crystal Bridges that we're delighted with the unexpected. We're talking to the Walton Arts Center, we're talking to the AMP, and we've got some really good connections. and we're all trying to work together to just build that arts corridor.
The renovation of the new theater is currently in the demolition phase, and construction is expected to begin sometime in October. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
John McIntosh says the renovations are expected to cost $8 million and have been funded by private donations. Speaking of theater, theater will be discussed this evening at 6 at The Vault in downtown Fayetteville. Bruce Warren, one of the more prolific performers for Theater Squared, will be at the bar to talk about his directorial debut for T2's next production, The Legend of Georgia McBride. He's acted with T2 in past shows like Around the World in 80 Days and The Ding Dong. He'll talk about directing the final T2 production in Nadine Baum Studios before next season opens across the street in the brand new T2 Theater. You can meet Bruce Warren tonight at 6 at Vault in downtown Fayetteville. The event is free. It's open to the public. Oh, and by the way, The Legend of Georgia McBride opens May 1st.
Caring for a loved one at the end of life is most difficult. But with the help of Circle of Life, families don't have to face it alone. Circle of Life Hospice has been offering compassionate care for patients and families for over 25 years. They provide end-of-life care from a professional hospice team with little to no out-of-pocket expense. Help is available at 1-800-495-5511 or on the web at nwacircleoflife.org. Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum and the Wall That Heals, on display in the Buckyball Field at Crystal Bridges from May 23rd to the 27th. This three-quarter scale replica of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., and Mobile Education Center are free and will welcome visitors 24/7. DowntownBentonville.org/wall to learn more about the Wall That Heals. Land for Life Gala, A Night Under the Stars, is Friday, April 19th at the Pratt Place Barn in Fayetteville. This inaugural fundraiser benefiting the Northwest Arkansas Land Trust includes a cocktail happy hour, farm-to-table dinner, entertainment from Fun Bags Comedy and Truman Railboys, an auction, and more. Tickets and information at nwalandtrust.org.
This is Ozarks Large. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News studio is Catherine Childs, our militant grammarian.
Hi, Kyle.
Hello.
You had a simple little question in the form of an idea for one of our conversations.
I did, yes.
And you sent it to me. What was it?
I asked, have we ever discussed the difference between nickname, pseudonym, and sobriquet?
Well, I suspect you really didn't know the depth of the question.
I suspect I did. Suspect.
It's deep.
Yeah. No, I suspected that.
Yeah. And we're only going to hit like the top six or something
okay.
like that.
Okay.
Using my favorite songwriting aid, Rhyme Zone, mm-hmm. I looked up synonyms for nickname. Moniker, alias, pseudonym, handle, epithet, nom de plume, moniker, appellation, among others. I mean, there were many more.
Okay.
So, to answer your question, I spent some time researching the differences among these words. The nickname, sobriquet, and...
pseudonym.
And pseudonym, yes.
Okay.
Okay. So, to answer your question, I spent some time researching the differences among these words. I'm here to report my answer.
Okay.
There are no differences. He's looking
what?
At me, unbelieving. Well, of course, now I'm going to talk for another minute or two about the differences between
okay.
them. But in general, they can all be interchangeably used.
Okay. Okay. I'm just going to bring up a figure, and then we'll come back to it okay. if you don't cover this. Babe Ruth. Okay.
Okay.
Just.
Well, you're talking about, yeah. Well, Babe Ruth is a, I think it would be called a super K. That's what I'm saying is that it's so mushy between the groups.
I'm going to hold off what I thought
right,
until
okay,
I hear
right,
you talk.
Right.
Okay.
Let's hear. At least no differences the scholars and just plain old word lovers can agree about.
Okay.
So let's start with the specific ones you asked me about, nickname, sobriquet, and pseudonym.
Right.
Nicknames may be derived from or related to what the person is well known for.
Okay.
So that wouldn't be Babe Ruth because
no.
he's not known as a babe. Maybe he was back then.
Yeah.
I don't know. The Angel of Death.
Dr. Kevorkian?
No. Well, actually...
No, he was...
Something else of death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joseph Mengele.
Yeah, well, okay, yes, yeah. Right.
Even worse.
Right. But no one called him Angel.
No, no.
But if, okay.
But they're saying that's a nickname derived from what the person is well known for.
Okay, okay.
Now, and by the way, John Wayne was called Duke.
Right.
Because as a boy, that was the name of one of his family dogs.
Okay. And he was often called the Duke.
The Duke. Right.
Right.
But,
right.
But it started
when
he was eight.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm making notes.
In fact, a nickname actually seems to be used as an umbrella term for many of the other synonyms. So it's like a more generic word for super gay.
Okay. So Babe Ruth, during his playing days,
we're still going to get there.
Okay, all right. I'll hold off.
Okay. He really wants to talk about Babe Ruth.
Okay.
The Sultan of SWAT.
Right.
That's different.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So I'm just going to shut up.
Just listen and see where you think that'll fit.
Okay.
Okay. In fact, to discuss sobriquet, we have to bring in a couple more synonyms: epithet and moniker.
Okay.
Okay. One writer puts it cleverly: epithets are the most easily spat of the three. In other words, you're calling them something. Yeah. Sobriquets are endearingly bestowed, and monikers are more neutrally or even cheekily coined.
Okay.
So there are some differences. By the way, I'm going to talk about these things that I read online. They were mostly in discussion forums, and I have no names to put with them. So. An epithet is a word, phrase, or title that describes an attribute characterizing a particular person. So the Sultan of Swing.
Is that Sultan of SWAT.
SWAT. Who is the Sultan of Swing? That's a song. That's a song. Never
mind. Was the Dire Straits.
Okay.
The Sultans of Swing.
Yeah, I love that song.
Yeah.
Okay. Usually an epithet is derogatory, but not always.
Okay.
We have Ivan the Terrible.
Right.
But we also have Catherine the Great.
Right.
A sobriquet is a nickname or familiar name that is bestowed upon someone, usually in a friendly manner. So I would say the Sultan of SWAT would be, be a sobriquet. The word comes from Middle French English word meaning a jest, literally meaning a chuck under the chin.
Okay. Okay.
And now consider moniker. One web writer says he thinks moniker is used when giving someone an unusual nickname, like a nickname that is not derived from their real name.
All right.
But from a certain skill they have or something they remind you of, Sultan of SWAT.
Right.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. They mix up so much.
But here's the thing. Isn't there a difference? Like, I doubt anyone ever went up to George Herman Ruth and called him
Babe.
Hey, Sultan of... No, they called him Babe.
Oh, they did? Okay.
Sure. I mean, that's what he was known as. So, hey, Babe, are you going to hit a home run today? But no one would have ever said, hey, Sultan of SWAT.
No, no.
So there's got to be a difference there.
Oh, yeah, I think so. And I think that the Super K may be maybe the Sultan of SWAT, whereas Babe is just a nickname.
Is a nickname,
or
exactly.
A moniker.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. But a pseudonym is different.
Oh, yeah, and we'll get to that.
Okay,
yeah,
all right.
It definitely is different.
Yes.
But they all still
describe
words people call themselves or other people call them that aren't their names.
Right.
Okay. So this writer goes on and brings in Super K. He says using Ed for Edward or Sue for Susan would be considered monikers or nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
But the shortened names don't describe anything.
Right.
Describing some attribute is a requirement for both sobriquet and epithet. So, Sultan of SWAT would be describing a guy who hits the ball a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be a sobriquet because it describes something.
Right.
And I'm thinking Babe would be a nickname because it doesn't...
He wasn't born.
I don't even know why he calls Babe, do you?
No.
Yeah.
No, but it wasn't his name, but it was what he was known as.
Synonyms, say that fast seven times.
Can't.
Include code name, nom de code, nom de guerre, nom de plume, pen name, stage name.
Right.
Probably others.
Right.
A pen name or nom de plume, which is French for?
What's pseudonym? Plume. Plume is pen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a pen name.
Right.
And nom often, de plume.
Right, and often referring to someone who's a writer.
Yes, right, right. It's a pseudonym adopted by an author. Some female authors used male pen names, in particular in the 19th century.
George Eliot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wasn't it George Sand? Was that another one?
Because the idea was that people wouldn't buy a book written by a woman, so you had to...
Exactly. Writing under fictitious name was a common practice in the 18th century when writers and journalists used synonyms to pen controversial or even illegal articles and letters to the editor. Okay. Finally, Kyle, I want to tell you my husband David's story about someone using a term for names.
Okay.
She was a teacher who spoke English as a second language. So the term challenged her. David was sitting in on her class when she told the students, "We need to know the nomenclature to study this topic." So you get it already?
Yes.
Of course, she meant
nomenclature.
Nomenclature, yeah. Right. The devising or choosing of names for things, especially in a science or other discipline. Nomenclature. It sounds like a scene from a W.C. Fields movie.
It does. Well, our militant grammarian, which is a sobriquet.
I guess it's, sobriquet, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
It's Catherine Sherrills, which is your real honest-to-God name.
That is, yes. Or two-thirds of it.
There you go.
What is the weather forecast for Titan? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. Although the Cassini spacecraft nosedived into Saturn back in 2017, the thousands of images and data are still being researched. Multiple images also mean multiple time spans when Cassini was at a specific place, delving into probable seasonal changes and evolution. The Titan community anxiously awaits any notion of clouds, which is a hallmark of seasonal change into Titan's northern summer and rainfall seasons. But something was wrong. There were no big fluffy clouds to be seen in the images. A team of researchers from the University of Idaho may have found the clue to the missing clouds. The team identified a reflective feature near Titan's North Pole, covering an area about half the size of the Great Lakes here in the United States. This feature did not appear in previous or later Cassini images. The large reflective spot is the equivalent to looking at wet pavement after a rainstorm, which glints off sunlight. The study then concludes that this was the after effects of a small methane rain event. This observation may help the Titan community gain more knowledge of Titan seasons and rainfall events. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with your host, Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Remember, you can make a gift anytime, online. Just go to supportkuaf.com.
The Arkansas legislature is not officially finished with business in 2019, but almost everything excluding formal adjournment is done. This weekend, Allison Williams, Chief of Staff for Governor Asa Hutchinson, sat down with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. She says the governor's office is pleased with how the governor's four T's package fared in the legislature, T's for teacher pay, transportation, transformation, and tax cuts. She says the bill that transforms state government by consolidation and reduction of the number of agencies reporting to the governor was a challenge just because of the scope of the legislation.
It's going to be a legacy for the governor, and people wanted to get it right. The governor said on your show a couple weeks ago that he was glad that the legislature was taking such a serious look at it, and we're glad to have it passed and signed yesterday.
Well, let's talk about what will go on with transformation. You guys have appointed a task force that is going to kind of, I guess, help navigate the transition for all of this. Amy Fetcher, who's on your staff, has been spearheading this for a couple years anyway, and she's in charge of that. When will we When will we see a cabinet head appointed?
Well, as the governor mentioned yesterday, he'll be making a secretary appointment sometime in the next 30 days. So he's taken some time to think about, the department's decided to think about who's the best to lead those.
Has he already given some thought? Do you think that I'm not asking you to admit who some of them may be. Do you think he has already decided who some of his heads will be?
You know the governor as well as I do. He always has thoughts. He's not shared them with me, but I do expect those conversations will happen soon.
All right. What else will the task force be doing in this interim period?
So the point of the transition team, it really comes out of the ideas that the governor and I both took away from our time in the Department of Homeland Security when that transition team was started. And the point being that you want these secretaries to come in and be as prepared to be successful as possible. So the transition team will be putting together binders of information regarding the agencies that are part of those departments, the grants that they have, the legislation that has affected them in this session, so that a secretary can come in and really get to work with their executive team when they get started in July.
Allison Williams, Chief of Staff for Governor Asa Hutchinson, talking with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics this weekend. You can see and hear more from that conversation at talkbusiness.net.
For the Central Arkansas Library System and KUAR, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. With her 1977 ordination at Little Rock's Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, Dr. Peggy Sue Bosmeyer became the first female Episcopal priest south of the Mason-Dixon line. Born in Helena on July 26, 1948, Bosmeyer had served as a deacon in Pine Bluff and an intern curate in Little Rock prior to her ordination. While some said women priests would tear apart the church, and one Episcopal leader stated that we've never had a woman priest back to year one, Arkansas Bishop Christoph Keller Jr. said Bosmeyer's priesthood emphasized not the maleness, but the humanity of Jesus Christ. Bosmeyer became program director for the Diocese of Little Rock and served as full-time vicar of St. Michael's Episcopal Church in Little Rock for 17 years. A gifted and insightful preacher, Bosmeyer was a role model for Episcopalian women throughout the church. She died in 1988, leaving a husband and four children. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
This is Ozarks at Large for the 15th day of April 2019. Thanks for spending part of your Monday with us. A new autism spectrum disorder therapy clinic called Autism in Motion recently opened in Fayetteville. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the clinic is part of a new franchise that aims to help young people on the spectrum.
Brandon Sykes, lead board-certified behavior analyst, gives us a quick tour of Autism in Motion Clinic, a new constructed facility on Garland Avenue in Fayetteville at the I-49 interchange. It opened April 1st.
So our building is designed, and we've kind of got two sides. We've got an office area, and then what we're walking into right now is kind of a general hangout play area. We've got a video game system over here. We've got a board game, and we've also got several little...
Sykes walks through the spacious clinic decorated in calming hues to show us a suite of therapy rooms, each one equipped with IT, cubbies, books, desks, and toys for the little ones, as well as a gym.
Trampoline, we've got big balls, giant mats to roll around on, play on.
Toddlers to teens with autism spectrum disorders will learn new behavior and communication skills here in order to better assimilate. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the incidence of autism continues to rise, with 1 in 59 children identified with autism spectrum disorders in the U.S., 20 years ago, the incidence was 1 in 150 children. The CDC says the disease may be genetic, caused by certain medications, or may be prevalent among children born to older parents.
Autism is a spectrum, meaning that every person that I encounter is completely different. And, you definitely have lower functioning people diagnosed with autism that maybe are nonverbal. They maybe lack in some social eye contact skills. But we also have kids that come in, and they do have some of those skills, but the area that they're needing help with is more social in nature. So learning how to greet, learning how to have reciprocal conversation.
Individuals with autism may show little interest in personal interactions, have trouble relating to and communicating with others, expressing their needs, they may prefer not to be touched and may react adversely to certain colors, textures, lights, and fragrances.
Yes, so early autism symptoms you may see are maybe lack of eye contact, some restricted and repetitive behaviors, so doing things in the same order, not having more than one or two interests, and so focusing in on just a few things can be one thing to look for. Sometimes we do see kids begin to develop on par with typical kids, and then we may see some regression in communication or eye contact, social skills. Sometimes they may like things to be put in a certain order. Sometimes kids may avoid loud noises, and it may kind of sensory-wise, they may like things to be done a certain way, whether it's related to auditory senses, visual senses. Sometimes they attend to things visually different, maybe looking from the side rather than straight on. And so that's some things that you may notice as well.
Early diagnosis is key, the CDC says, which can lead to early intervention to help children on the spectrum to better mainstream in life. There's no cure for autism, but recommended treatments may include dietary changes, conventional as well as complementary and alternative medicines and treatment and behavioral intervention. Applied behavior analysis, ABA, has become the gold standard among autism disorder healthcare professionals and is used in many schools and clinical settings like this one.
So ABA, yes, is basically the study of human behavior and how we can apply that to solve social situations. We have the expertise to go in and analyze why behaviors are happening. So sometimes we have kids that have a difficult time communicating, and so they maybe use aggression or they maybe use property destruction, things like that, to communicate with their parents and families. And so our goal is to go in, one of our goals is to go in and figure out what can we teach as a replacement skill that they can use in the real world that will work for them instead of the aggression or the property destruction. So increasing any skills that are going to bring more happiness to that child. Autism, a lot of times they don't develop skills naturally. They don't learn in that kind of natural classroom type situation. So ABA can break these skills down into very concrete steps for the child and work on those very incrementally, kind of providing that one-on-one instruction. And then we also eventually can hopefully translate those skills to more natural situations.
As part of their ABA therapy, autism and motion therapy staff employ functional communication skills.
Functional communication is going to be teaching that child either to say apple, to sign apple, to use some other communication form such as there's so many devices out there now that we can use. Teaching kids to say all done, ask for help, I need a break, things like that also can replace some of these aberrant behaviors that can be seen sometimes with kids with autism.
ABA treatment, Sykes says, can range from 10 to 40 hours per week.
Those 40 hours are going to be spent across environments, so clinic, home, school, community. And the reason for that is kids with autism sometimes need that practice across environments because they don't automatically generalize those skills.
Sykes would not disclose how much autism in motion charges per hour for treatment. Arkansas is among 48 states with laws mandating insurance coverage for ABA therapy services, depending on the type of insurance. The clinic hopes to soon accept Our Kids, Arkansas Medicaid insurance for low-income children, pending approval.
So what we do is we run their insurance and we kind of come up with a financial contract. But one thing that's really unique and great about AIM is they work with the families. They don't want cost to be a financial barrier. So we set up payment plans and we even have financial assistance programs that they can apply for. So we never want cost to be a barrier to therapy.
Autism in Motion is a privately owned new franchise with clinics in Bryant and Fayetteville, along with two more opening in Little Rock and Norman, Oklahoma, founded by Sherry Homeshack. When her two young sons were diagnosed with autism in 2000, Homeshack, then a practicing optometrist, moved her family to South Carolina to obtain in-home ABA therapy, which at the time was a relatively new treatment. She eventually became ABA certified and began to help other families, as well as lobbying for medical state waivers for ABA treatment. With Chicago-based business partner George Bohos, they launched this franchise?
Georgia's main goal is developing ABA in rural areas and making sure that also we have a really strong professional development program trying to bring up new BCBAs, new RBTs in Arkansas, because there's still limited staff to help all the kids that need help.
Community-based autism therapies attracting investors due to rising public demand, yielding, according to Disability Scoop, an industry news site, more than $10 billion in revenue in 2017. That doesn't include school-based providers. The report also cites critics who worry the new clinical marketplace lacks standards, which could be developed by academic institutions, the insurance industry, and government regulators. According to the advocacy group Autism Speaks, many states lack ABA regulatory oversight and strict clinician licensing rules remain scant. In Arkansas, it's optional for clinicians to obtain board ABA certification, a process overseen by the Arkansas Board of Examiners and Counseling. Autism in Motion, however, is staffed by several board-certified ABA therapists, as well as senior registered behavior technicians and part-time employee interns. Client intake involves clinical staff first meeting with parents of children diagnosed with a spectrum disorder to measure and set goals.
And then the second process is going to be a direct with me as the board-certified behavior analyst, assessing the child and kind of looking at, after we've done both of those, we have a third meeting where I'm going to put together all of the goals for the parents and for that child that we think are going to be most helpful for him, and then we have that final meeting before we'd ever get started.
Autism in Motion can be found on Facebook and the web. The clinic held an open house in late March, offering pony rides, refreshments, and tours. More than 200 turned out. The clinic is currently networking with disability nonprofits and advocacy groups to help as many children as early as possible in their lives. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Just ahead on today's show, this week's edition of Arkansongs. Yes, Tiger Woods' comeback is the big story of the 2019 Masters that concluded yesterday. But a pair of former Razorback golfers did well at the tournament as well. Alvaro Ortiz earned the silver medal for accumulating the second-best score by an amateur golfer at the tournament in Augusta, Georgia. Overall, he finished tied for 36th and became just the third ever Mexican-born golfer to play in the Masters. He is a 2018 graduate of the University of Arkansas. Andrew Landry, a 2009 Razorback graduate, finished the four-day event at even par and tied for 46th place. The Razorback baseball team is off today, but back at Baum Stadium tomorrow night for the first ever matchup between Arkansas and Arkansas Pine Bluff. The 8th-ranked Razorbacks won yesterday in Nashville, defeating number 6 Vanderbilt 14-12 after dropping the first two games of that series. Tomorrow night's game against UAPB scheduled for a first pitch at 6:30. The Arkansas softball team also hosting UAPB Tuesday night for a 6 o'clock game. Arkansas brings a 5-game winning streak into the contest after sweeping a 3-game set from Furman this weekend in Fayetteville. And the University of Arkansas Fort Smith baseball team is idle until Thursday, when the Lions will travel west to be at Oklahoma Christian in Oklahoma City to begin a 3-game weekend series. UAFS, by the way, just 4 home games left on the schedule, beginning with a game May 3rd against Neumann University.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Arkansas-er Washboard Sam became one of the most prolific and commercially successful male blues performers and writers of the pre-war era. He was born Robert Clifford Brown in Walnut Ridge in Lawrence County on July 15, 1910. Other sources say Brown was born a few years earlier in Jackson, Tennessee, but agree he grew up in Lawrence County. Brown honed his chops busking as a street musician in nearby Memphis, alongside such fellow future blues legends as Hammy Nixon and Sleepy John Estes. Brown and his cohorts played a subgenre of blues known as hokum, more broadly known as jug band music. Hokum often deals with humorous or risque lyrical themes, backed by such readily available instrumentation as acoustic guitar and harmonica, often with a washboard scrubbed for percussion and air blown into a jug for bass notes. Memphis was a mecca in the 1920s for the jug band blues style, which would give Washboard Sam his nickname and make his name.
Hey, mama, don't lie, no, no. shining, yeah. Here's a mama, don't lie, no neckness shining, yeah.
Brown relocated to another burgeoning blues music hub, Chicago, in the early 1930s. He cut his first record there in 1935. It would be the first of many. A clever songwriter, Brown found a big hit early on with Mama Don't Allow. It's now one of those standards from the American songbook that seems like it's always been around. The version here is from the summer of 1936 with Big Bill Brunzi on guitar. Robert Brown would end up recording dozens and dozens of sides from the mid-1930s into the mid-1940s, most for the notable blues record labels Vocalion and Bluebird. In addition to his popular stage name Washboard Sam, Brown also recorded under the names Ham Gravy and Shufflin' Sam. Despite the success of Mama Don't Allow, Robert Brown's songwriting career was no one-hit wonder. Muddy Waters later became better known for Brown's song Diggin' My Potatoes, heard here, than Brown himself. This and other titles, like Dirty Mother For You, Who Pumped the Wind in My Donut, and Soap and Water Blues, show Brown's hokum side. Even in a genre known for washboards, Brown was well regarded for his washboard skills. Publicity photographs of the era show Brown attached bells and a metal platter to his oversized washboard to expand his instrument's sound. You can also hear it in Brown's many records. In fact, Northeast Arkansas can claim the two most famous washboard players in American music when you couple Washboard Sam and Jim Dandy, the frontman for the rock band Black Oak Arkansas.
You say get more older every day.
And Brown has an equally important legacy as an in-demand sideman. He was part of the Bluebird label's house band, appearing on many of the label's classics. He recorded with popular blues men like Booker White and Phillips County native Roosevelt Sykes, but Brown's most important collaborator was Big Bill Brunzi. Raised and likely born in Jefferson County, Brunzi was one of the biggest blues stars of the era. Known as Big Bill, he and Brown were said to be half-brothers, both fathered by Frank Brunzi, but that's never been proven definitively. Not in dispute is Washboard Sam and Big Bill's musical lineage. Heard here is Big Bill and Washboard Sam from 1940, featuring Joshua Altimer of Altimer in Jefferson County on piano. But Brown's musical career, red hot for a decade, began to cool after the end of World War II. More combos, like those of Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, were plugging in electric instruments to get songs across. In the post-war years, washboards were becoming unnecessary in blues bands even faster than they were in American laundry rooms. It would have likely seemed ironic to a Windy City stalwart like Brown that the electrified blues sound that emerged became known as Chicago-style blues, although Howlin' Wolf called it the West Memphis style.
Come on back, oh baby, won't you come on back? Come on back, oh baby, won't you come on back? I ain't 6'2", but I know just what...
Brown continued occasionally performing and recording through the 1950s. It's said he also became a Chicago police officer. In 1953, he recorded at Chess Records with Willie Dixon. Dixon would later pay him homage by mentioning Washboard Sam in the lyrics to Wang Dang Doodle. After reportedly being admonished by his musical peers for not taking advantage of the international renewed interest in the blues, Brown did a short tour of Europe in 1964. In Chicago later that year, Brown made what would be his final recordings. Robert Washboard Sam Brown died of heart disease in Chicago on November 6, 1966. He was buried at Cook County's Washington Memory Garden Cemetery in Homewood, Illinois, in an unmarked grave. Decades later, in October 2009, a marker for him was finally placed after a fundraiser by blues fans in Michigan. On the headstone is an image of a washboard, like Brown's, with its custom platter attachment. Here in its entirety is Arkansas-er Robert Washboard Sam Brown of Walnut Ridge in Lawrence County with Who Pumped the Wind in My Donut from 1935, with Black Bob on piano and Big Bill Brunzi on guitar.
Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure resemble me. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Down on that yam yam tree. I wasn't there when the pumping was done, but whosoever pump a pump, son of a gun. Who pumped the wind in my donut? Sure don't resemble me. Who pumped the Van and Madonna sure don't resemble me. Pompey, Van and Madonna down on that yam yam tree. I like Madonna nice and sweet, but everybody tears them up and down the street. Oh, Pompey, Van and Madonna sure don't resemble me. Down on that yam yam tree. I like my donuts nice and round, but everybody tears them all over this town. Who bumped the wind in my donuts? Don't resemble me. Don't resemble me.
Washboard Sam of Walnut Ridge with Who Pumped the Wind in My Donut from 1935. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
The Walmart amp is adding to the 2019 season with Maze featuring Frankie Beverly with Johnny Gill. The concert, scheduled for Sunday, September 8th in Rogers, was announced this morning. Tickets go on sale Friday morning at 11 through the usual Walton Arts Center outlets and range from $30 to $99.50. Maze with Frankie Beverly, one of the most enduring soul and R&B groups, recording and touring now for more than 40 years. A band that has not been together quite as long, but we love them just the same, Hadmaine Bowmans, will release their first ever vinyl recording, Pawpaw Tree, Friday night at George's Majestic Lounge. The duo has been on our show a few times, and they'll be back in Northwest Arkansas Friday night with Heirloom opening the show and California-based Nathan and Jesse also playing. Music begins at 9 Friday night. You can learn more at the Handmade Moments Facebook page. And the entry deadline for the Tiny Desk contest at NPR now passed. The last chance to enter a song was last night. 10 Arkansas-based musicians and bands entered this year. Judges are now watching every single video submission from around the country and will announce the 2019 Tiny Desk winner in May. You can go to tinydeskcontest.npr.org and see the entries for yourself, then pick your own winner. And later this week on Ozarks at Large, we'll hear from some of the Arkansas musicians who entered.
State of the Art will premiere Friday, April 26th at 8 p.m. on the Arkansas Educational Television Network, AETN. Viewers can meet seven of the under-recognized contemporary artists found on an exhilarating year-long journey for a groundbreaking exhibition at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville. State of the Art on AETN, Friday, April 26th at 8 p.m. AETN.org for more information. The 8th annual Fayetteville Foam Fest is Saturday, May 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Fayetteville Historic Downtown Square. This craft beer sampling will feature over 50 local, regional, and national breweries while raising awareness and funds for local charities. General or VIP tickets are available. FayettevilleFoamFest.com for more information. 91.3 is supported by Penguinette's Barbecue, offering weekend breakfast each Saturday and Sunday, 7 to 11 a.m., at the Mission and Crossover location in Fayetteville. Menu items include breakfast taco, omelets, pancakes, and more. PenguinEds.com for information.
And contributors for this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzana Sitek, and Jacqueline Froelich. Timothy Dennis mastered our show today. Additional content provided by Talk Business and Politics. You can read more at talkbusiness.net and KUAR Public Radio in Little Rock. Our militant grammarian is Catherine Sherrills. A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, this is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Sonora. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Thanks for listening. I'm Kyle Kellums. We will be back tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. with new stories, interviews, and information. You can also hear news and information from around the region tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30, Inside Morning Edition, with our newscast from Antoinette Grajeda. You can always find out more about us at ozarksatlarge.com. Thanks for listening. Have a great rest of your Monday.